Just to introduce Fleur Edgecock really briefly, she was saying how she wants this to be just a sentence, basically. So she was born in New Zealand, but has lived in England since 1963, and her books are all published by Bloodaxe. The most recent ones are Dragon Talk, Glass Wings, and the latest one is The Land Ballad, from which she will be reading today. She has also published translations, edited several anthologies, and written libretti for musical works. In 2006, she was awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry. But before she's going to read from her latest collection, she is also taking part in the English Penn and Ledbury Poetry Festival's joint initiative, which is called Poetry as Protest, to highlight the many poets currently at risk as a result of their work. At risk means here imprisoned, prosecuted, persecuted, attacked, threatened, forced into exile, or even murdered around the world. So throughout the festival, we'll have poets reading their partner poets' poems. And Fleur Edgecock has agreed to read the Chinese poet Liu Xia's poem, Another Kind of Death.
Thank you very much. I'm glad not to have to try pronouncing Liu Xia without help. She was a founding member of the Independent Chinese Pen Center. She's married to the imprisoned poet Liu Xiaobo, and ever since he won the Nobel Prize in October 2010, she herself has been under extra-legal house arrest. So I've seen a video of her, which is very moving. It's a secretly filmed online video by American Pen. But actually, she is not able to communicate, and she can't even read her husband's letters or he read hers. So all we can do is try to speak for her. And this little poem I'm reading is called Another Kind of Death, but it's about a mute child, and you'll be able to put your own interpretation on that in a world where everything stands for something else. Joseph, the mute child, stands in the shadow of a piano, dark as a big blackbird. Sunlight doesn't reach him, and neither does the candlelight from the hospital chapel. I can't touch him with my hands. He stands there year after year as the pages of the music book turn. As the pages of the music book turn, he stands there year after year, and I can't touch him with my hands. The candlelight from the hospital chapel doesn't reach him, nor does sunlight. In the shadow of a piano, dark as a big blackbird, Joseph, the mute child, stands. And that was translated by Ming Di and Jennifer Stern. Now, we go back 100 years, almost exactly, actually. This is a book about my father's early life in New Zealand. He and his parents emigrated in 1914, and they were on their way to New Zealand when the war broke out. Same thing happened to me. I was on my way to England when I was five, and the war broke out in 1939, so we were kind of haunted by wars. And then they tried to set up this dairy farm, and you had to put your name in a hat to be allowed to bid for some land. It didn't matter if you'd been saving up for years and years to buy it. You couldn't get it because of wartime restrictions unless you took your chance. So this book is called The Land Ballot because of that. And this poem, The Pioneer, explains the system and introduces my grandfather, Sam, and his wife, Eva, my grandmother. The way the land ballot worked was like this. If your name came up, you might be offered the block you'd applied for, or another, which you had to take, or you got nothing. Meanwhile, you looked for something else to do. Sam was a master packing case maker, but New Zealand made no packing cases. His other mastery was hairdressing. He found a job in Tiwamuta with a barber called Dwen, and they waited, renting the teacher's house at Tirahu, 3 miles away, befriending the farmer next door, learning to milk and waiting, while ballot after ballot came up null and waiting, and buying a horse and waiting. When they heard, he rushed hot foot to see it, his 150 acres of bush at Tiwamuta, halfway along the road, if road it deserved to be called, from Otorohanga to Kawhia. As if to meet a new mail order bride, he strode off, perhaps quaking a little. Things turn folkloric if you wait too long. He went by train to Otorohanga and then walked. It may have been 20 miles. At one point he had to cross a river. Unable to swim, he waded through it. 1 mile road frontage of native forest to be transformed somehow into pasture, waiting on that mountainside. Up he trudged. You had to walk everywhere. Oh, there was a mail coach that could bring in his wife and child eventually when they'd managed to clear some of the bush and build a house. But this is where they came from. This is what they brought with them of where they'd come from in Manchester and their previous lives. And this poem's called Baggage. Sealed in their heavy luggage in the hold, they'd brought the encapsulated highlights of their shared lives. Eva's sewing machine and her Watto Dalton dinner service. Sam's tools, of course. The tea urn his father had made using his skills as a tinsmith, learnt in the packing case trade. Some books, the postcard album, bulging with 8 or 9 years of miniature correspondence. And the oval portrait, painted in her 60s, of Sam's apple-cheeked grandmother, Mary Adcock, née Pell, or perhaps Peel, in her plaid shawl, who came out of nowhere. As for the books, they ranged in weight down from the Bible through Sam's other sacred text, The Amateur Carpenter and Builder, to a pocket-sized sliver, Hoyle's Games. Packed side by side with Sunday school prizes, John Cotton, A New Temperance Tale of Lancashire Life, was something different. The awful disclosures of Maria Monk, convent, nuns, dead babies, a dollop of bigotry for the new country, which had its own, and an unexpected read for a bemused future grandchild to pluck from the glass-fronted bookcase Sam would build. I've got some of the other books. My son Andrew, who's inherited the carpentering skills and the books, has got The Amateur Carpenter and Builder, but I don't know what happened to Maria Monk. Best lost, I think. This is the bushfire. Everything went wrong, of course. They were too hopeful, and the soil wasn't suitable for dairy cattle. It was lacking in cobalt, and the young stock died, and the climate was disastrous. And so they were a bit short. They had to put their milk out, their cream out in a churn for the butter factory to take away, and then they'd make butter out of it and pay, but there was never enough money. So Sam went off with great relief, I think, back to be sociable again in Te Awamutu and chat away to customers in the barber shop, leaving my young father, who was about 13 at this time, to milk the cows and make the fences and look after the farm while his mother did other things. So this is the bushfire scene from Sam's point of view. There was his wife with her eyebrows burnt off. They never did grow back again properly. And his barely teenaged son running round with wet sacks to batter the flames out. Just what Sam himself would have advised if he'd been there, instead of standing miles and miles away, scissors in hand, outside the barber's at Te Awamutu, watching the smoke. They had no telephone. Someone had to go and earn money when the cream check failed. And someone, young Cyril, had to mind the farm and milk the cows. So he missed it, poor Sam, the great bushfire, the striding flames and the filthy black swirls that choked you even through a wet handkerchief. Eva was left with a lasting phobia, Cyril with an intimate knowledge of how each type of bush timber burns, and Sam deprived of a first-hand claim to a first-class story for his customers. Anyway, he passed it on down the family. The sources for this book were all sorts of things, from family stories, reminiscences, diaries, brief diaries, not journals, but you know, appointment diaries with addresses in them, and stuff I found online, including the embarrassing incident about Cyril's late grandfather Charlie in his youth and the sheep. But I don't think we'll go into that. You can read about it here. They were very cautious about their terminology in the High Court. Anyway, I will look back at another sidelight, and this is Eva, his mother. She was a rather gloomy woman. She was sort of okay to us as kids, but I somehow felt she was, you know, never really on our side. She was a bit miserable. And many, many decades later, I discovered the reason for it. She had been one of 11 children, and only four of them survived into their 20s, or died in their 20s of TB, several of them, others of all sorts of other awful things in Manchester. And this is... I imagine here Eva looking back on her two brothers called James. Victorian families tended to reuse the names if a child died. We all find that a bit morbid now, but I think they were just doing it out of sort of pious remembrance. So she's looking back on her two brothers. When she thinks, if she does, of the first James, it's of a six-year-old who died when she was 14 of meningitis. His spirit, like a trespassing sprite, flew into his parents' marriage bed and lurked there as they comforted each other. A month later, conspiring with the genie of ovulation and the hormone fairies, it implanted itself in a fertilized egg, to be born in July 1890 and loaded with the same eight syllables, James Arthur Dixon Eggington. He didn't resemble his first avatar or any of his incarnate siblings at Eva's wedding, this gladsome imp with his long chin. When TB clutched him, "I am still improving," he wrote from his sanatorium in Devon on a photograph of six young men reclining on the grass around a nurse like petals flopped from a magnolia. James is the one with the longest legs, the centre parting, the fetching moustache, and no intention of dying celibate. He willed some health back into his lungs, found work, tacked 5 years onto his age, and married an older woman while he could. How's that for carpe diem? 10 months to bask in matrimony, wisely or not, before death stalked him to Babbacombe. Well, I think he was actually 22, and he lied about his age on everything. But he was the of the generation that if he hadn't died then, he probably would have died in the war. So sort of depends on which you prefer as a fate. Not that he got the choice. But some of his other brothers went to the war, and this refers to one of them. Some of these poems are written in the voice of my father, so I say Cyril speaks because we tape-recorded him, my son Andrew and I. He had a huge reel-to-reel tape recorder, and we got lots and lots of footage of my father's talking about his youth. And this poem is in two parts, and it's about what they felt about the war. They were all nervous of it, although New Zealand is so far away. And from living high up on this mountain, they could see down to the sea. This is called The Germans. From our front window, we could peer down at Kaffir Harbour, a quiet place, ideal for the Germans to land. I indulged in fantasies, but with an undercurrent. An unknown farmer moved in next door, a spy, obviously. The boundary between us and the spy needed quite a length of fencing. I don't know when I've worked so hard on a fence. Two. My Uncle Harry, Mum's youngest brother, was invalid at home from the Somme with something. Rheumatic fever, they thought. His heart was enlarged. Or perhaps he had shell shock. His mother dared not nurse him. The responsibility unnerved her. Instead, his sister-in-law volunteered, Thomas's wife. She said he had fits. I've got several other war poems, but that is, well, this Battle of the Somme began 100 years ago yesterday, so that is particularly apposite. Anyway, it ended Armistice Day, and my father was given a bit of a break from his duties. By then, I think he'd left school and was working on the farm and studying by correspondence for his civil service entrance exams. Of course, the only way to get any education if you had no money and couldn't go to university was to become a teacher. So he was going to train as a pupil teacher, and he did that. But this is a little break. He was 14 when it ended. His father gave him a day off to ride into town for the celebrations. Ambling along on Molly's back to Te Awamutu, he whiled away the miles absorbed in his new treasure, a textbook on organic chemistry, saved up for out of his earnings from doing Charlie Honnery's milking. After the fireworks, his retina stenciled with their acidic blaze, he wondered how easy it would be to make some. He might have a go with Bert Daish, assuming they could get the ingredients or get away with trying to get them. He could hardly add them to his parents' next routine order from Laidlaw Leeds for oatmeal, sugar and fencing wire. They could celebrate the New Year, perhaps, or the King's birthday. He'd think of something, now that there would be no more wars. Ever hopeful. This is poems called The Hopeful Author. He amused himself. He was always making things, inventing things, making a sort of pre-crystal set model of a wireless and anything scientific. But also he wrote stories, and I found one written out carefully in his youthful handwriting, which he'd been obviously sending out to, hopefully to various American magazines, I believe. And so this is the plot of that story. The professor in a scientific capture, with the detective by his side, effects an entry into the spy's house by lassoing a chimney, shinning up the rope and removing a window pane. He installs his first little contrivance, a glass-lidded box behind a mirror, and another under the wallpaper, each connected to the telephone wire and then in turn to a large battery outside the house. Then, are you still with me? Back at the professor's lab, they can watch the villain's dastardly doings on a cinematograph, but one which can play, unlike commercial models, a soundtrack. All very advanced, like the flying tank, of which the prototype has been stolen by the spy. To ratchet up the tension, when they're on their way to arrest him, the detective's car runs out of benzene. It all works out as it should in the end. More wires, another battery, the spy electrocuted at his own front door. On the back of the much-creased final page, see Adcock, remit US bills and stamps. They never arrive. Have we got time for two more? One more. Two.
You can go for two.
Okay. No. Moment of madness. This is called Walking Off, and it's what happened to all the families in the neighbourhood. Eventually they gave up, or they got out, or the depression came. Eventually they discovered that you could improve the land by top-dressing it from a plane with cobalt, and then they started to run sheep on it. But these are some friends, neighbours of my father's family, called Oscar and Susan Dassler, and they gave up. And Susan was a bit of a writer. She wrote a little booklet of poems and stories called From a Pioneer's Pen. This is their exemplary story. Walking off. Take the Dasslers, for example. Even with a buggy and two horses, they were walking, leaving it all, turning their backs, quitting for somewhere closer to sea level, where they needn't top-dress the soil with cobalt and their young stock didn't wither away. But the farm just had to sit there, languishing, for anyone who might wander by and want it, while ragwort sniggered in the long grass. And the hall couldn't up and walk off. It lay under its drooping macrocarpus and wilted, letting the blackberries crawl over its roof. The piano is still under the wreckage. No one revived the post office that Susan Dassler had run in her front room. The butcher's shop and the hut by the roadside where you helped yourself and recorded your purchase in a notebook somehow faded away. A bus took the children to Nutanui. And after all, what else had there been but the hall, the butcher's shop, the post office and the school, wrote Susan Dassler with her pioneer's pen. And I'll end with the last poem. State Highway 31. I went back once with my father and son and my stepmother in the 1970s when the school was still standing and the house had sort of been replaced, but you could see where it was. And then I went back with that same son grown up 3 years ago, and there's nothing, Tiramore didn't really exist. There was just signs by the roadside and occasional farm. So this is State Highway 31. The owners of the land round here haven't spent their time preserving obsolete structures for potential grandfather chasers to post on Facebook. They don't prop up decaying trees with splints and crutches like the King's Oak or some contorted trunk proclaiming where the early settlers landed. But what did we expect? After all, we'd viewed the naked course of the road on Google Earth and compared it with the busy splatter of habitations on the old sketch map. And at least we've identified the hillock where the school stood, then and in its posthumous life as a hayshed. As for that iconic row of stumps in front of, yes, the former homestead, what apt a portrait could we ask of posterity's heartlessness? So this is the last time I'll say how, as we sailed past non-stop on the way back from Kaffir, my stomach yearned for just one more glimpse.
Thank you, Fleur, for this wonderful reading. Our next poet is Hannah Lowe, and her first poetry collection, Chick, was published by Bloodaxe in 2013. It won the Michael Murphy Memorial Award for Best First Collection and was shortlisted for the Forward, the Fenton Albright, and Seamus Heaney Best First Collection prizes. In September 2014, she was named as one of the 20 Next Generation Poets by the Poetry Book Society. Her family memoir, Long Time No See, was published by Periscope in July 2015 and featured as Radio 4's Book of the Week. Her second collection, Chan, from which she will be reading today, has just been published by Bloodaxe. But she too is starting with a poem by the poet that was paired with her on the Poetry as Protest scheme. Welcome, Hannah Lowe.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm going to read a poem in solidarity with Marvash Sabat, an Iranian poet who has been imprisoned since 2008. She is a leader of the Baha'i community, religious community in Iran, which is the sort of second biggest faith group after Islam. And she has worked kind of in education, providing an alternative higher education for young people of that community, but was imprisoned for crimes such as the establishment of an illegal administration, which was the college that she established, and sending secret documents outside the country. Having been imprisoned in 2008 with four others, her sentence was then reduced from 20 years to 10 years in 2011, only to be reinstated to 20 years in 2012, which I think must have been absolutely crushing for her. She started writing poems in prison in 2013 and had a collection published in English translation. So for Marvash Sabat, I'd like to read her poem, Hello Again. Last night, in the midst of unsettled darkness, I found myself at the axis of the earth for a moment, holding it taut between my outstretched arms. And as I struggled to keep those frozen poles apart, I saw I could prepare these icy limbs and melt them wondrously between my two hot palms. So there I stood on the summit of the loftiest peak, a simple woman growing with love again, ready to salute the world once more. So I'm reading today from my new collection, Chan, and really this is the first time that I've read from this book exclusively, so I'm slightly nervous, happy, really pleased to be here to share it at Ledbury. And some of the poems have their Genesis in a notebook written by my father that I found after his death. He died when I was in my early 20s. And in fact, this notebook, I'd seen it around the house when I was a child, but I'd never known its content. And then my mum posted it to me probably 5 or 6 years after he died. And in it, he gives an account. It's only 30 pages or so of his early life in Jamaica, where he grew up. His mother was black Jamaican and his father was Chinese. And he'd grown up in rural Jamaica with his Chinese father, who was a shopkeeper. And by all accounts, my grandfather was a very difficult man. He had a huge kind of gambling proclivity, which my father inherited, actually. But that got him into quite a lot of trouble. He was often losing his shop and they were having to move on again. But in the notebook, my dad talks in incredibly restrained terms about his life with his father, which is really an upbringing of neglect and abuse. So all of the text in this poem is my father's words. It's all found material. One of the things about the notebook, actually, I noticed that my Chinese grandfather seems to get married on every other page. But so you'll hear mention of quite a few women. There's never any divorces mentioned. So my grandfather, the bigamist. So the voice is my father. So when I talk about he, that's my grandfather. My father's notebook. I do not know the exact date of his birth, of his arrival to the island. He hardly ever spoke, except to give commands. Most nights he was nowhere to be found. I would walk the empty rooms crying for him or go out into the road. Once a woman saw me on the bridge and brought me home. After, he tied me to my bed with rope. He lost all his money 3 times, burnt down our shop, the dogs trapped below the galvanized roof. He gave me an orange and we drove off. He had a cousin across the river. A waterfall cascaded on the road and my father carried me over. He got married the first time in Mocho, but I cannot recall the lady's name, only that she was nearly white. Her father was McCormack. They had a baby, and her name was Gloria. He opened a new shop, bare shelves for months. We slept in the back with Linda Bloomfield. I heard them in the night. I cannot recall if they were married. He went to Kingston for days to play Mahjong, came home angry, beat me with his belt. I can still recall the heat and smell of him, of sweetness and liquor. He had children in villages all over. He got married to Bonella. I saw babies and never saw them again. I held a baby called Zita, my sister. Last time I saw him, he begged me for money. He was smaller. The time before, I'd held his gun to his head while he slept, but I didn't pull the trigger. He died in 1963 or 1964. I can't remember. My father's mother, Hermione, was 15 when she had him, and she was a servant in his dad's shop, so there was no romantic relationship. And as far as I know, she raised my father for his early life, maybe till he was 4 or 5, and at that point, she felt she could no longer look after him. She was from a very poor family, and he went to live with his father, and my dad believed that an exchange of money had taken place, that his father had given money to his mother for him, effectively bought him as a lackey to work in the shop. Since my dad certainly died believing that, but since that time, from conversations with family members, some questions have been raised about that story. But there's certainly a lot of mystery around my grandmother. And we only have one photograph of her. In Jamaica during sort of colonial times, there was a real, in many ways, so many kind of mores and manners of British culture were copied in Jamaica. So particularly the photographic portrait, the quite formal portrait of people in their best clothes, just staring impassively at the camera, was very much adopted in Jamaica as well. So the one photograph we have of my grandmother Hermione is in this sort of quite a beautiful organza, white organza dress, staring solemnly at the camera. But everything else I know about her gives quite a different impression. There's so many questions about her. So another poem now in my father's voice about his mother. My mother wore a thimble made of copper. My mother was a seamstress or a chambermaid or market girl or nurse or cotton picker or washerwoman, fingers blistered red from strangling sheets in lime and washtub water. She disappeared through linen on the line, and like a mockingbird, I heard her laughter, a teaspoon on good china, lady fine. My mother was a photograph. Her name was longing or desire. She stumbled south along the parish road, barefoot and shamed in dirty lace, gin bottle to her mouth. My mother was a hand in a long white glove, the moment before the glove is pulled off. So my dad left Jamaica in 1947 to come to Britain, as did thousands of... actually, that time, not thousands, it began with hundreds, but became thousands of Jamaican men and women seeking better opportunities abroad. So the poem that I'm going to read to you now is a kind of account, I guess, of what it must be like to leave behind everything that you know and that is familiar. So I hope it has a kind of contemporary relevance as well. It's about making a sea journey. But really what I have in mind are all the kind of incredibly sort of difficult and painful negotiations that come with leaving, and then what it must be like to arrive somewhere where perhaps your expectations of the place don't chime with the reality of that place. I sort of use a gambling metaphor at the beginning because my dad was, you know, all his life in London, he worked as a poker player, if that was work. And certainly he was doing that before he left for England as well. But on the passenger list for the ship he travelled on, he rather imaginatively calls himself a clerk, which I think quite legitimises himself. The poem is a glosa, which means that it's a four-stanza form, and the last line of each stanza is taken from a quatrain from another poem by another poet. So perhaps you'll hear those lines being repeated. I'll read them to you now. They're from a poem called The Waking by Theodore Retke. And the lines are, this shaking keeps me steady, I should know. What falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. What I know. At night, you find me at the oil lamp, dice in hand. I say to myself, if I throw a pair of fives, I'll give up this life. The hot, slow days of hurricanes, sweet reek of banana rot, black fruit on the vine. I want another hand of chances. I grip the dice and blow a gust of luck into my fist. I'm dreaming of England. Yes, work. Yes, women, riches. I shake these bone cubes hard, let go. This shaking keeps me steady, I should know. The radio fizzes news across the tenement yard, days soldiers sailing home, a weekend parade, monsoon time coming. I pass dead horses in the field, dead mules. Men sag like slack suits in the square. Talk of leaving starts like rain, slow and spare, a rattle in a can. My tears aren't for the ship, new places or strange people, but the loss of my always faces. I mean my people, who I know, my places. My sister says, you carry them with you, don't fear. What falls away is always and is near. The ship rocks steady across the ocean. You ever look out to sea, and on every side is sky and water, too much, too blue. Thoughts lap at me like waves against the bow, not where I am, but why and who. At night, we use our hours up. 10 fellows flock to someone's sticky room. I roll my dice or deal for shemmy, brag, pontoon. We go till dawn, a huddle at the lamp turned low. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Some fellows swore there were diamonds on these streets. Look hard enough in rain and you'll see them. I squint my eyes, but what I see is sunshine on the dock, my mother's white gloves waving me goodbye. There's no diamonds here, or if there are, they're under this skin of snow. Seems the whole world's gone white. I roll my dice in basements below these English pavements. I guess I'm learning what I need to know. I go by going where I have to go. Thank you. I'm just going to have a sip of water. I've been writing a series of poems, and some of them are in this new collection in a form which may or may not be my own invention. I haven't seen any other poems like it, but that doesn't mean that it's brand new. But I've called this form a borderliner. And I found this term, borderliner, on the internet when I was doing some research into the language that is used to denigrate people like me of a mixed background, dual heritage, mixed race, whatever term you want to use, and also like my dad was. And borderliner is a term that I've found that is a derogatory term for someone who's mixed race, essentially. And I started thinking, it's so interesting, this idea about being on the border, because to me, I think to be from that kind of background means that you can look in all directions, perhaps, you know. And I think I wouldn't have had it any other way, I suppose. But I also began to think about how these borders are policed. So in terms of, like, race, transgression across races is policed by this kind of language. And also border transgressions, geographical border crossings are also policed, as we know, and increasingly so in the modern world. So I've written in this form that essentially mashes two poems together, one in bold and one in non-bold, and there's a kind of porous border between them so that you can read across the line, as well as the whole lines of two poems, as well as the single poems and columns. I'm sort of wanting to show you, but you won't be able to see at all from here, but there's one poem here and one poem here, and a porous border between them. So I thought, if you'll permit me, that I'll read you both poems and then read them across to perhaps hear some of the kind of new meanings that maybe come out in the borderliner. So I'll begin. The first poem is about geographical border crossing, and the second poem is about racial transgression and that kind of crossing. Borderliner. I'm skirting the bold lines of the map, neither here nor there, but home in the border places. Tijuana, where rich American boys slam tequila or control drugs, or down the fence where a veiled woman clutches her baby in the thin shadows, always waiting to cross. I've always loved sea swimming, but sometimes these waves carry makeshift rafts bobbing empty of their cargo, the seabed cross-hatched with bones. But there were times when these borders had no barbed wire. And even now, not all borders are so hard. There are places nobody cares to pass. Think of that frozen mountain trail where only a tin sign tells one snowy Nordic edge from another. Or miles of rough green marshlands where I've wandered for days. That I'm home on the border doesn't mean I don't think about who took the world and carved it up. And then the other poem. Borderliner might mean white girl with corkscrew hair or brown girl with flat hair, slipping from one side to the other, always looking for the right light, passing, hoping the old world didn't catch her up, a good day or hey girl in the wrong hotel or store, some fool too loud, not seeing the signs. That kind of stuff could put you back in chains or end with the blade. But ever notice how green eyes in yellow skin look so good? How some faces have no borders, no fixed abode. You can sketch a pretty rainbow diagram or use faux scientific words to classify slang relating to nation states or chocolate bars or animals, mongrel or mule. But I say it's only when you're standing on the border that you are free to look both ways. And now I'll read across. I'm skirting the bold lines of the map. Borderliner might mean white girl, neither here nor there, but home in the border places with corkscrew hair. Tijuana, where rich American boys slam tequila, or brown girls with flat hair, or controlled drugs, or down the fence slipping from one side to the other, a veiled woman clutches her baby, always looking for the right light in the thin shadows, passing, hoping the old world wouldn't catch her up. I've always loved sea swimming, some fall too loud, not seeing the signs, but sometimes these waves carry the kind of stuff that could put you back in makeshift rafts, bobbing empty of their cargo, or end with the blade. The seabed. But ever notice how green eyes in yellow skin, crossed hatch with bones, look so good? How some faces have no borders? There were times when these borders had no fixed abode. You can sketch no barbed wire, and now not all borders are a pretty rainbow diagram. There are places nobody cares to pass or use faux scientific words. Think of that frozen mountain trail where only a tin sign classifies, or slang tells one Nordic edge from another, or miles relating to nation-states of rush-green marchlands, chocolate bars or animals, mongrel or mule. I say it's only when you are standing. That I'm home on the border doesn't mean on the border that you are free. I don't think about who took the world and carved it up to look both ways. Well, while the Polish are getting it in the neck in Britain, I thought I would read a poem about an early Polish immigrant to Britain, a guy called Chananel Milifev, who renamed himself in Britain as Chan Canasta. Does anyone here remember Chan Canasta? Yes. So my dad had many nicknames. One of them was Chick, which was the name of my last collection, and another one was Chan, and he was nicknamed Chan after Chan Canasta, who was a television card magician in the 1950s and 60s. And you can Google Chan Canasta now and watch these fantastic YouTube videos. He was known as being a magician, but also a pioneer of what they called mental magic. In other words, he was a mind reader, I suppose. And so in these black and white footage of him, you see incredibly debonair, charming man, spoke sort of beautiful English, and he would be dealing the cards out to the guests on his show, and then he would always be able to basically tell them what was in their hand. And another trick he did was the book trick, where he would say, you know, choose a page number, and the guests would all, you know, have these page numbers in their head, and he would give the book out, and he would say, now, you know, find me some lines that you like to, you know, have in your head what number page and what number of the lines. He said the 10th and the 11th line, and then he would be able to read to them the lines from the book that he had in their head. So I have no idea how he did any of those things, but he's a very fascinating figure to me. Chan Canasta, and like I'm doing in lots of these poems in this new collection, I'm giving myself the liberty to have known these people. So in this poem, I become Chan Canasta's confidant, really. If you believe one pale eye. If you believe I met Chan Canasta in 1962, after hours in the cold at the stage door, Canasta sweeping through in his long black coat as I called out, "Sir, sir," and he turned and loomed above me like a vampire. You may as well believe any of the things I dream about watching his old TV shows. The way he handled a deck of cards up close, they couldn't catch it with a camera, like pulling a silk scarf through his fingers. Or the Slavic ghost in his voice, conducting his cards to his guests to pick a card or think of a card, but please, ladies and gentlemen, keep it secret. Or how he held them all in the corner of one pale eye, and you knew somehow he'd read their minds. You may as well believe that night we walked down by the canal was the first of many times. The narrow boats in their carnival colours moored in the mist, the smell of tar, and Chan not looking at me, but talking, as though I was the first person to ever ask him of the family in Krakow, lost in the war, of the shaded roof garden in Jerusalem, where he had read book after book on occultism and mesmerism and practiced his experiments. If you have talent, you must polish it until it glitters. And how he remade himself in Britain, pilot, magician, English, Polish gentleman. Was it the first light coming up brought silence? We sat by the lock, Chan pulling his cards from his pocket and holding each one up to his lighter until the flame spread and the symbols and faces cindered and he flung them out across the dark, still water like firebirds. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, it brings me now to the last little sequence of poems that I'll read for you. And for anyone that was there last night would have heard me reading a poem about the jazz drummer Phil Seaman. I thought maybe I could elaborate on that and say that my interest in Phil Seaman begins with another musician called Joe Harriott, who was my dad's cousin and also my mum's first boyfriend. It's how my parents met through Joe Harriott. Joe's on the, a painting of Joe is on the front of this book, and Joe Harriott and Phil Seaman played in the same quintet. And Joe's really interesting to me for all kinds of reasons. Obviously, there's the kind of family connection and also the fact that he's the only really other kind of artistic person in my family. So I kind of really sort of look up to him, I suppose, as a kind of creative antecedent in the family. The other things that interest me about Joe is that his music was probably really too far-sighted for its time. So he's now considered to be the forefather of avant-garde jazz in Europe, like an equivalent of someone like Ornette Coleman in America. But he was much neglected in his lifetime, even though he was a brilliant musician and quintet leader. He died very young at 42 in terrible, terrible health, much neglected by the musical establishment, possibly because of race, possibly because he was too much for the musical establishment. And he was effectively homeless when he died. So in this poem, it's another one of these, if you believe poems, you'll hear that I get to meet Joe Harriott and we spend time together. And I should just say that Richard, who pops up in the poem, is my partner, the poet Richard Price, who, when I started writing these poems, said to me, you can't just write what you want, you know, about real people, like famous people. And I thought, well, I'm going to stick you in this poem. And then that will be the caveat, that will be an end to that. So he pops up. If you believe ribs. If you believe I saw Joe Harriott play in 1956 and in my good blue dress danced all night in that basement dive below Gerrard Street, Joe howling through his sax, white shirt, sweat-soaked and gleaming in the spotlight, you may as well believe any of the things I dream on listening to his music. The way he smelt up close, say, of cigarettes and clove when we took a corner table at the New Friends on Salmon Row, gnawing the ribs he loved, and in between chews, just talking to me in that fatherly way he had. You may as well believe that sometimes I put his records on and just start crying and can't stop crying, don't even know what I'm crying for. Those decades in history when men like Joe and my father were shadows on English streets, or just the way a melody can get you. I walk the small rooms of my flat, light spilling through the skylights, the treetops just in sight through the glass, and even with all these tears, I'm sort of happy. Richard says, be careful what you do in poems to real people, known people. But surely this poem shows it seems enough to let me wish that Joe didn't start dying so young at gigs he couldn't even stand up straight to play, that men he used to jam with didn't see his broken body shuffling down the streets and turn away, and those last morphine days, the dog he saw barking in the window of the third floor ward really wasn't there. Well, how could it be? if Joe and me just stepped from the club into this winter night, walking arm in arm down Brewer Street to order steaming bowls of wonton soup. Two very short poems about Joe, and then I'll finish with a monologue. So I talked a lot to my mum about Joe Harriet because she was his girlfriend on and off for about 5 years, actually. Whenever my mum talks about Joe, the air turns blue, really, because he was a fantastic musician, but I think he was a bit of a womaniser as well, and also quite a drinker. So you'll hear that in some of these, in these two poems, I think. There was also something about Joe. Someone said about Joe, Shake Keane said, who was his fellow trumpet player in his quintet, if alto sax players had been sort of genetically developed like some sort of amoeba millions of years ago, Joe was that. He wasn't really a person. So, like, all he was the saxophone. So, sax one. That gold horn hung out of you nightly like a distended tongue. The fix you craved at the Sunset Club or the Blue Room stage or the generous hours you played in backroom jams. Oh, boy, you needed it. Raja, theorist, sire, the way you saw yourself, that gold bone stuck up, perked up by hot white girls on stools who lapped you up. But the sex that night was solo, Joe. Eyes closed, your throat wide open, walking alone the gold road to heaven. Joe said that about his Americans, yeah, jazz scene was so dominated by America, but Joe said about the Americans like Charlie, you know, Charlie Parker and John Coltrane, what those guys play is in the room, but what I play is out the window. My mum said that she'd go around to Joe's flat and the first thing he'd do is suggest that she go down to the pub and buy them a bottle of Beaujolais because he never had any money. So my mum said, you know, that's what she remembers about Joe most, is paying for and then drinking Beaujolais with him. Sax two. Joe, go down for Beaujolais or send your woman down. The landlord knows that liquor's yours. Now close the door, now breathe, now drink. Now lick the reed, now flick it. That white girl's riding buses back across the town. Put down your cup, lift your baby from its velvet snug. Belly full of blood, now blow that gold. Joe, blow it. What you play is out the window, out the room. Okay, and I'll finish with a monologue in my mum's voice talking about this kind of burgeoning relationship with Joe Harriet and my nan, my mum's mum, who was, by all accounts, a right old racist, to be honest, had a complete fit when my mum, at 18, started going out with Joe, a black Jamaican man who was in his mid-30s. So that you'll hear all of that language in this poem. So when I say my mum, it's me and my mum's voice talking about my nan. The poem is called Cherokee, and it's named after a jazz standard, Cherokee, that my mum particularly loved Joe's version of. And there's a little epigraph from this for this poem by my mum, Bette Lowe. She says, "I was playing with fire." Cherokee. He phoned me up. A party, would I go? My mum said, Joe? Who's Joe? A darkie? No, not on your Nelly lady. No, you won't, you. Peach lipstick, lacquered beehive, tweed Miss Perfume. I took the bus, and of course there was no party. Just a room with whiskey glasses on the bedside and fag ash on the tangled sheets at dawn. Oh, he could play an ace, could Joe, the Aki Blues and Cherokee. Da 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 da. He put his sacks in hock to pay the rent, said, Betty, can you help me? Had a pound off me on Sunday night. He had it bad. He'd not been with another girl in weeks. And no, my mother didn't sleep a wink. She sobbed into her mixing bowl. Then off we went to Auntie Connie's caravan. He wore his suit and wingtips on the dunes. He said he loved me in the spinning teacups, then vanished in the night. Oh, he knew a tune, that bastard arsehole drunk. You'll never know, and Cherokee, da 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 da. And no, I couldn't bring him home for Christmas. Not over my dead body, lady, no. He came with flick knife smile and lilac bath cubes, and oh, she sobbed into her mixing bowl. My father walked him to the tube, came home and stank of whiskey, said, "He's just like any other fella, ain't he, Betty? Ain't he?" Thank you.